previously on Unsolved. I called instead from the car. Len Snowden picked up right away. He told me he had nothing to do with Father Kuntz' murder, and he was not happy the police had treated him as a suspect.
I didn't know that much about him, to be honest with you. But these guys, they kept piling one thing on top of the other, making assumptions, and when I finally got disgusted with them, I said, unless you pull a Mark Furman on me, which means adding, you know, putting evidence out there that, you know, you're not going to have to find a thing. You're not going to find a hair from my body or anywhere near that place. You won't find any evidence whatsoever.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, Season 3, The Devil You Know. I'm Gina Barton. Len Snowden, the tattoo artist we heard from in the previous episode, only came to the attention of the police after Maura Smith gave them his name. Remember, Maura is the waitress who served in the Marines and says she's clairvoyant. She told the police she had dated Len, but stopped seeing him after Father Kuntz told her he had a criminal record. Maura also told the police Len changed his routine after Father Kuntz's death.
He used to come to the diner all the time to flirt with me every day. And right after Father Kuntz's murder, he wasn't there for about maybe 9 days. When he showed up, he had cuts all over his face and his knuckles were all cut up.
She says he looked like he'd been in a fight, but he wouldn't tell her what happened.
I said, hey, what's all the cuts? Because I won't talk about it. And then he was defensive with me instead of the friendly, flirty type of guy.
When I told Len Snowden what Maura said, he laughed.
That you had some kind of injuries to your face or your hands around that time.
Not in my mind. I mean, who in the hell would I have a fight with? I never went out anywhere. I was never disrespectful to anybody. Never got drunk. You couldn't find me in a bar anywhere unless I was playing with the band. And whoever told them that stuff didn't know what the hell they were talking about.
Detective Gwen Rupert is in charge of the case today. She says, by the time detectives met with Len Snowden, whatever injuries he may have had were almost gone.
And I don't even remember there being bruises. I just remember, like, healing scrapes. And, like, they saw faint marks on his face. Whatever it was, wasn't quite gone away yet.
Okay.
We were very suspicious about that.
Len Snowden did agree to provide a DNA sample. As I mentioned in the previous episode, it didn't match anything found at the crime scene. It doesn't match the new evidence police discovered in 2011 either. Remember, Detective Rupert wouldn't tell me where this new DNA evidence was found. But she says it's somewhere significant. Somewhere the killer would have had reason to touch. She believes it's connected to the murder. But the folks at the crime lab told her it's not 100%. That's because they can't tell when the DNA got there. It might not even be connected to the crime. Maybe it even came from someone who handled the evidence later.
I'm told by our wise evidence people, it could have gotten there some other way. I don't see how it could have, other than the struggle and the fight, but I'm told that if it rules somebody out, you can't just completely say it ruled them out.
The DNA profile also can't be put into the National Data Bank because it's only partial. It would yield a match of only one in a few thousand versus the one in millions you get from a full profile. That means it can't totally prove someone innocent, and it can't be used to help the police come up with any new suspects either. In any case that goes unsolved as long as this one has, the police not only follow up on new leads that come in, they try to keep tabs on people they spoke to at the time of the crime, both witnesses and suspects. Carrie Porter is the lieutenant of detectives in Dane County. He tells me they have definitely kept track of a lot of people involved, or potentially involved, in this case.
I think our thought is that there is still somebody out there that probably knows more than what they've talked to us about before, that they're holding on to information that for whatever reason they haven't been willing to give up. And if that's the case, maybe over time, if we keep this up, that somebody at some point will change their mind and decide that they're going to tell us everything they know about it.
That's because things change as the years go by. And sometimes those changes could make someone more likely to talk to the police. It could be the perpetrator himself. You know, the deathbed confession scenario. More often, it's a witness. Maybe the killer told a family member or a friend, and then they have a fight, and so that person doesn't have a reason to keep the secret anymore. It also happens a lot that when people get arrested, they tend to give the cops tips on other crimes in hopes of getting their own charges reduced. Earlier this year, several listeners contacted me to tell me a man who made news in connection with the Kuntz case 20 years ago had been arrested again. His name is Robert Pulvermacher. Not long after Kuntz's murder in 1998, WKOW aired a story about him.
Deputies and detectives are trying to find 47-year-old Robert Pulvermacher. The sheriff's department says Pulvermacher is not a suspect in the Kuntz murder case, but he is wanted for violating conditions of his probation.
He has had a local Dane address at one time, currently does not live there now, but has apparently still ties to the community and frequents the community.
The sheriff's department wants to question Pulvermacher, who has a history of burglary and theft. Pulvermacher is just one lead the sheriff's department is pursuing at this time.
You may recall that at that point in the case, one of the prevailing theories was that Kuntz was murdered during a robbery gone wrong. So that's why the police wanted to talk to Pulvermacher. The police eventually located him and questioned him about Father Kuntz's murder. Pulvermacher said he didn't know anything about it. Later, the police said Pulvermacher had a good alibi, so they ruled him out as a suspect. But that's not what happened in this new case. In January 2019, Pulvermacher was arrested on a homicide charge.
Robert Pulvermacher is charged with the murder of 88-year-old Harold Johnson of Portage. Authorities say the men met up at Baraboo's Ho-Chunk Casino so Pulvermacher could settle a $100 debt. Instead of settling that debt, a criminal complaint states Johnson was stabbed 5 times, stabbed in the back.
Pulvermacher is in jail now, awaiting trial on that homicide charge. Unfortunately for the Dane County Sheriff's Department, his arrest didn't prompt him to come forward with any new information about the Kuntz case. Another person who was questioned in the Kuntz case and has been back in the news in recent years is a man who calls himself Ryan St. Ann Scott. 5 years before the murder, Scott was convicted of felony misconduct in public office for altering a check while he was serving as finance director for the city of Edgerton, Wisconsin. Back then, he was still using his given name, Randall Dean Stocks. That's the name retired detective Wayne Honer knew him under. As it turns out, the two of them had gone to the same high school.
And I remember him as a kid at the school, and I was like a senior, and I remember him as being a younger, one of the lower grade classmen, but he was never, I never thought anything that he was ever going to be a self-proclaimed priest later on in life, but that's apparently who he was, and I remembered him from school.
That's right. He said, self-proclaimed priest. I'll let Detective Rupert explain a little bit more about that.
So he had, you know, set up little, not shrines, but like a little place where he lives, and he pretends like he has his own church kind of thing that people would come to. He knew Father Kuntz beforehand. We knew of his meetings with Father Kuntz. He wanted Father Kuntz to work on his behalf for him to be recognized in the diocese, or in the Catholic Church in general, but in the diocese especially, so that he could be a priest and do priest stuff. I think Father Koontz had kind of been putting him off, but politely. There was never any time that he, you know, stomped out of the church or anything. But he had actually met with him in person a few times, and he had some hopes in that direction. I think Father Koontz didn't have any intention of it, of him, or, you know, doing anything like that. And even, I want to say before that, not long before that, the La Crosse diocese, the bishop had actually put out a letter about Father Ryan St. Anne Scott, whatever he was calling himself at the time, and just said, look, do not entertain him as a real priest in your area. And we, in this diocese, they got a hold of that too, so they knew about him.
Wayne Honer says the detectives investigating Father Koontz's murder questioned Scott at one of these chapels that he had set up.
I mean, when one of our co-workers went out to interview him, and he talks about meeting a nun that was like 12 years old, dressed in a nun's habit at his so-called church out in, or was it Lancaster or Fenimore or something like that. And he just jumped when he saw this girl that's probably 11 or 12 years old, dressed up in a black and white nun's habit. And that was Father Ryan Scott's church that she was part of. And that was a pretty bizarre sighting at that point when he walked in the door and saw that.
Ryan St. Anne Scott's alibi for the night of Father Koontz's murder was that he was at home in bed. Detective Rupert tells me he was living in what he called a rectory at the time with another guy who may or may not have been a priest. The roommate said he was also home asleep, and as far as he knew, Ryan St. Anne Scott never left the house. Detective Rupert tells me Ryan St. Anne Scott later changed his name again to Ryan St. Anne Scott Gevlinger. He started going by that name after he convinced an elderly woman named Rosanna Gevlinger to adopt him in 2010. He was in his 50s at the time.
He moved around a little bit. He was in Iowa, and then he went to Missouri. And I got contacted 3 or 4 years ago by a reserve deputy who had a lot of time to spend on this guy. At some point, he became aware that Mrs. Gevlinger adopted him.
In 2015, Ryan St. Anne Scott, under the name of Ryan Gevlinger, was charged with financial exploitation of an elderly person in Howard County, Missouri. That charge, which listed a different elderly woman as the victim, was ultimately dropped. Scott sued the sheriff's department there for wrongful arrest and malicious prosecution. The case was settled for $92,750. He did plead guilty to a state charge of illegal gun possession and was sentenced to 5 years of probation. In a strange twist, the woman who adopted him, Rosanna Gevlinger, was from Wisconsin. And as it turns out, the detectives investigating the Koontz case had spoken with her relatives as part of the murder investigation.
And Mrs. Gevlinger is from Mineral Point. She's of families that we had talked to, like strong Catholic families in the area. They had their own, like you have your own backyard chapel, and like you could get the Mineral Point pastor or priest to come out and say a service on Sunday afternoon or on a special day or something for you. Gevlingers were like that down in Mineral Point, and she was of that family, and somehow he hooked up with her and convinced her to come and be with him, and he'd set himself up in kind of an old school down there, and like supposedly he was developing a church, but it was never open to the public.
Detective Rupert tells me Rosanna Gevlinger is now back in Wisconsin with her family. I emailed Ryan St. Anne Scott telling him I wanted to speak with him about Father Koontz. He actually wrote back. He told me Father Koontz was an exceptional friend, personal confessor, mentor, and brother in Christ. He asked me for assurances that I would include what he had to say in its entirety and unedited. He signed the email as Reverend Father Ryan St. Anne. I wrote back and explained to him that I record all of my interviews and I would do my best to present his story fairly, but we couldn't promise to use every word he said. In the end, he turned me down. Here's part of his last email to me read by a colleague of mine in our newsroom.
After careful consideration and a great amount of prayer, I have come to the conclusion that my participation in another news story would basically be of no assistance and further would only serve to cause me more years of harassment. I tried for several years to bring forth the truth of the evil embedded in the so-called Catholic Church, an attempt to right the wrong, only to have the press turn me into the problem and dragging me through the gutter rather than telling the truth of the matter at hand, which I'm sure you will agree is much larger than any of us.
In the email, Ryan St. Anne Scott characterized Father Kuntz's death as, quote, a calculated assassination, end quote, designed to prevent Kuntz from testifying about clergy sexual abuse before the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Last year, on the 20th anniversary of Father Kuntz's death, the Dane County Sheriff's Department turned to social media as a way to try and solve this homicide. They modeled their social media campaign after one that was done in Florida about the case of Christy Luna. Christy was 8 years old in 1984 when she disappeared during a short walk from her home to the corner store. After Christy had been missing for 33 years, the cops in Florida came up with the idea of posting on Facebook and Twitter in first person, as if Christy herself was making the posts. The police got a lot of leads in response, but they still haven't found Christy. Detective Rupert tells me she and Detective Jennifer Nyber decided to try a similar strategy, setting up a Facebook page in Father Kuntz's name.
In recent years, even on the anniversary of his death, we weren't really getting any tips. So we kind of, Jen and I kind of hatched the idea of the social media campaign that we did for the 20th year anniversary. And that absolutely generated a bunch of tips.
One of those tipsters was a man who said he'd recovered a repressed memory of Father Kuntz being involved in abusing kids. So far, the police haven't been able to find any corroboration for his claims. One woman who posted on the Facebook page said Kuntz was, quote, disturbed and needed help, end quote. I got in touch with that woman, whose name is Jane Everhart. She lives in Denver now. She didn't have any knowledge of Kuntz acting inappropriately with kids, but she says he pursued her romantically, and he was pretty aggressive about it. Her story seems to fit with what the police have said about Father Kuntz having relationships with women, even though Catholic priests are supposed to remain celibate, and no one who's a member of the church is supposed to have sex outside of marriage. Jane says her father worked at a Volkswagen dealership. Father Kuntz bought several cars there over the years, and he would bring them in for service. She says he would occasionally ask her dad how she was doing. Jane says after her dad told Father Kuntz she'd gotten divorced, he started dropping by her house. She had 3 young children at the time.
I didn't solicit his visits. I really didn't want his visits. I didn't think I needed his help. One night he said, I'm going to put the kids to bed. We'll give you confession. Oh, joy in your home, just what every woman wants, you know. I was not married in the church, so he said to me, your children are conceived in sin. He then proceeded to ask me the following. What kind of birth control are you on? I need you to make a promise you will not be with a man for 5 years. You know, we get through this confession, I'm thinking, none of these things are your business and highly inappropriate.
Jane says she didn't answer the questions and she tried to get Father Kuntz to stop coming over, but he wouldn't. She says that eventually, whenever she saw his car, she would go across the street to the neighbor's house to avoid him. When he managed to take her by surprise, she says he would overstay his welcome. He would say he had just taken a lot of prescription cough syrup and he couldn't drive safely.
One of the last times he said, I can't drive, he was sitting in the rocking chair. I grabbed his rosary. I said, we'll say this really loudly while you drive down the road with your windows down.
That was the type of behavior, Jane says, prompted her to post on Facebook that Father Kuntz was disturbed and needed help. Within a few days of her post, the Father Kuntz page was taken down. Jane believes it was taken down on purpose because she and several other people were saying things the cops or the Catholic Church didn't approve of. I've heard from other people who have the same suspicions. But the sheriff, Dave Mahoney, tells me that isn't the case. He says Facebook took down the page, and they never would give him a straight answer about why. He says everyone in the department was baffled when it happened, since the detectives had been working with Facebook's law enforcement liaison and had gotten approval for the social media campaign ahead of time. After that, the sheriff's department did keep up the campaign on Twitter. But Sheriff Mahoney tells me it didn't have the results they were hoping for.
It didn't give us the particular break that we were looking for to solve the case. It generated some more people of interest and has allowed us to at least bring this case back into the forefront of Dane County's citizens in hopes that, you know, we will, again, maybe there's somebody who had a family member that said something 20 years ago or maybe came home and acted differently that they've been carrying with them for 20 years. And to kind of free their soul and their conscience, we hope that they'll come forward and talk with a detective.
In March 2018, during the weekend of the 20th anniversary of Father Kuntz's death, the Madison Diocese put together a Requiem Mass to pray for the repose of his soul. In other words, they were coming together to pray to get Father Kuntz's soul out of purgatory sooner. Catholics believe that before people can go to heaven, they have to spend some time in purgatory. That doesn't include people who have been canonized as saints, but it does include priests. Father Scott Jablonski, the current pastor of St. Michael, explains.
I always like to explain to people the whole concept of purgatory. It's really kind of like a spiritual bath, so to speak, a spiritual cleansing. And, you know, I always use the analogy, like, you know, when I was growing up, my grandmother loved me. She loved me through and through. Every time I went to her house, she made my favorite foods, cookies, all that. So, you know, if I was out with my cousins playing in the backyard and we got all muddy playing football or something like that, I could come in and, yeah, grandma loves me and she'd definitely want me to, like, come and, like, sit at the table and eat. But, like, there'd also be that part of me that, like, would have so much respect for grandma. Like, I want to go, like, wash up a little bit before I sat down at the dinner table. Like, I know that she loved me, but at the same time, like, I also had this desire to want to, like, be clean, to be presentable for grandma.
He says Catholic teaching holds that, like grandma, God loves you no matter how messy you are. But there's a part of every person that wants to be perfectly clean before God and the saints.
And so the whole idea of purgatory is this place to kind of have that purification take place that we've kind of rejected in this lifetime.
Father Jablonski told me that the people left behind here on earth can help those departed souls achieve the grace of heaven by praying for them. I figured that certainly Father Kuntz, being a priest, would have made it to heaven after 20 years. But Father Jablonski said, only God knows for sure. Peter Kelly, Father Kuntz's good friend and co-host of his radio show, told me he keeps a kneeler in his office for just that reason.
And I say prayers every day for priests that I know that have passed away, including Father Al Kuntz and Father Charles Fiore. I pray for their souls in purgatory. It's an old Catholic tradition. Priests have a terrible time because everybody assumes they're in heaven already, so nobody prays for their souls. So I just keep going and let God sort it out.
A Requiem Mass is another way for people to help their deceased loved ones get out of purgatory faster by praying for their souls. The one for Father Kuntz was said in Latin, just as he would have wanted. The priest was Father John Zulsdorf. The only time he spoke English was during the sermon. And even during that brief time, I heard an echo of Father Kuntz's strict, old-school teachings.
Everybody here is going to die. It might be foreseen because of age or illness. It might be because of some accident or by violence. The bottom line is that one day, your heart will stop, you will draw your last breath, and you will die. One day, we are going to get God's justice, whether we want it or not. It is a great work of mercy to pray for the dead, and so we gather here to pray for the soul of Father Alfred Kuntz, who died 20 years ago. And as we pray for him, we might remember that one day we will go before the judge, before whom every thought, word, and deed will be inescapably revealed.
For many of the people who knew Father Kuntz, their Catholic faith has been a comfort as they have mourned him over the past 20 years. But for the police, some of the church's laws have served as a source of frustration. In particular, a lot of the cops got hung up on the sacrament of reconciliation. It used to be called confession. It's when someone tells a priest their sins and the priest prays with them. According to Catholic teaching, if someone makes a sincere confession and truly wants forgiveness, God will forgive any sin, including killing someone, including killing a priest. In most cases, the priest who hears a confession will tell the person to do penance, something to make up for their sins. In my experience growing up Catholic, the penance always used to be saying a certain number of prayers or a certain number of rosaries or something like that. Father Jablonski told me that in the case of someone who confessed to a murder, a priest could not require them to go to the police in order to be forgiven.
Yeah, we're not allowed to make that a requirement, but I think as a good priest, you'd have to say, I really, in strongest words possible, like, you need to really, really, really consider doing this. Because otherwise it's hard to believe that you really are remorseful for what you've done. You know, there's something to be said about, you know, you've caused some sort of damage in the earthly realm, and you need to do something here on earth too, if possible, to atone for that. Doesn't make up for it entirely, because you're not going to bring him back, so to speak, but it's a way of ensuring that there's justice that prevails in the earthly community as well, because if we only said, go to confession, that's all that matters, well, we'd have anarchy here on earth.
Still, there's no hard and fast rule, which is troubling to Detective Rupert.
Our concern has been a little bit that, you know, if somebody confessed it, they don't act guilty anymore, and they don't need to worry about it. They're done. They confessed it to their God, they've been absolved of their sins, and so I'm not going to act guilty.
The other thing about confession is that priests can't tell anyone what was said in the confessional, even if someone admits to murder or to some other terrible crime. Father Kuntz himself once talked about that very thing on his radio show.
And people must understand that, so that let's just take a case of a contrite murderer, someone who has deliberately been guilty of homicide. He confesses this. He is intentionally sorry. The priest's lips are bound totally. He cannot in any way make reference to the fact that he heard the confession of a murderer on such and such a date or whatever, or in such and such a place. He must totally protect that with his life in any way.
That's hugely frustrating for the investigators who have worked on this case, including Detective Don Johnson.
And that's the problem with every priest that we talked to. They all said the same thing. We're not telling you. They made it very clear, every single one, we aren't doing it. We will do everything in our power to convince the person to turn themselves in, but we will never give you their name. That hurts.
Another core of Catholic teaching is forgiveness. Stephen Brady, who worked with Father Kuntz to hold Illinois Bishop Daniel Ryan accountable for sexual misconduct, doesn't think a private confession to a priest would be enough for Father Kuntz's killer to gain forgiveness.
As I know as a Catholic, anyone can be forgiven, but you can't be forgiven if you don't confess. So if the individual's not ready to come out and make it right, he can't be forgiven. It would take a public confession and some type of contrition, maybe jail time, if you will, because I don't think anybody could be forgiven of something as horrendous without a public confession, admission, because he's caused so much public harm. It's not a private issue like committing adultery or something like that. It's something very public and very damaging to the church community in general.
The Bible says that as Jesus was being put to death, he prayed for the people who crucified him, saying, "Father, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing." Morris Smith says a priest once told her Father Kuntz probably did the same, forgiving the killer who took his life. For herself, Maura told me she believes more in the Old Testament teachings on retaliation, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth.
And I remember speaking to a priest because I broke down, and this priest said, "Hey," he says, "don't worry about him. He's probably forgiven the guys who had done it." And I said, "Well, I haven't. You know, I'm kind of an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth type gal."
I asked Peter Kelly if he thought Father Kuntz had forgiven his killer.
It's an interesting question if Father Kuntz had forgiven that person, because that would have to take place when he's struggling in his last moments. I thought about that. As he's lying on the floor with his blood, you know, spilling out onto the school floor there, I would have thought Father Quinn's, while still conscious, would know his position. Because if you have your throat cut and you're dying a bit in those precious few moments where you still have consciousness, I think the thought would certainly go across your mind that you're going to die within the next minute. So, and if you're a priest like Father Kuntz, who spent decades and decades as a priest knowing death, judgment, heaven and hell, he would do everything he can to make the best act of contrition he can and to forgive the assailant before things go dark.
That's our season. Thank you so much for listening. And stay tuned for a bonus episode after our live event. And if you have any information about the murder of Father Kuntz, please call the Dane County Sheriff's Department's tip line. That number is 608-284-6900. That's 608-284-6900. To explore the case on your own, with videos, photos, police reports, and documents, go to jsonline.com/unsolved. Unsolved is reported, written, and produced by me, Gina Barton. Our sound engineer and videographer is Bill Schultz. Photographer, Mark Hoffman. Artist, Lou Saldivar. Web designers, Aaron Coy and Andrew Malika. Our editor of local news and investigations is Greg Borowski. Our copy editor is Debbie Davis. Our theme music this season was composed by Evan Johnson. The TV news clips you heard in this episode came from WKOW in Madison. I also want to thank Donna Billmeyer, Miles Moffitt, Ashley Lutheran, Meg Jones, Tom Ketting, Rachel Piper, Emily Risto, Anissa Johnson, Rick Wood, Brian Kranz, Joe Hanneman, Elena Weissman, and Taylor Palmby for their help this season. And please support local journalism. You can subscribe to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel at jsonline.com/deal. Thank you.